everybody. Welcome back to another episode of Bootstrap Web. Brian, how you doing, my man? It's my third podcast in 24 hours. I'm in top form on podcasting. Let's do this.
Yeah, let's do it. Yeah, looking forward to another week. We got 2 weeks in a row here, so I think we're just going to be kind of yakking about whatever, because not a ton happens in 1 week, and unless you're Card Hook, and then everything happens in a week. So we'll see.
It does feel that way. You know, I was up late last night writing an investor update. It took me a good 3 hours, and I meant to write this about a month ago, but so much new information kept coming at me that I couldn't write the update because I knew whatever I wrote would be different a few days later. And it took a few weeks to sort out, and it finally felt stable enough, like, okay, I think I have the right facts to start making assumptions based on, and then I could communicate about it. But it was complicated when there's so much going on for you running the company. It's like, what, how do you distill that into enough detail so people are in the know, but not too much detail? You don't want to overwhelm people. You don't want to be like, you know, write a book for them. So it was pretty tricky, but I think it came out good. We got some good responses. It's like a very, very private newsletter.
Yeah, of course. You know, I've been doing, you know, also writing monthly investor update emails to my, they're not investors, they're just friends and advisors. It does take a lot of work to write that thing. I know most of the people on that email probably just like skim it or sometimes don't read it. Some people reply and give me some good stuff, but like I do it for myself more than anything, to be honest. It's really helpful to just write it out and have to report on what happened and to give my thinking on what's next. It's a good exercise. I'm about like 6 or 7 months in, and I'll definitely keep doing it for sure.
Yeah, I like it of yours. I get 3 or 4 of those, and I read them all, even if I just respond with one word like awesome, good job, good luck, sounds like X. I haven't added anyone outside of our investor group to ours. It feels so private. It is like the real thing. You know, like there are layers, right? This podcast is for public consumption. Then it's like conversations you have in private. Then conversations you have with your team. And the conversations you have with your investors, it's like...
It's almost even more private than with your team, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You don't want your team to worry about everything that you worry about. You know, and I have been sharing it more with my leadership team, right? So we have like team leads, and I found over the past 6 months or so, the more I share with them, the better I feel, which is a little tricky, right? You don't want to just make yourself feel better, but freak everyone out. And the truth is, it's not really freaking people out. I can tell they're almost like more, they're all mature. They're smart. They can handle it. And I think in many ways, they have a better like relationship with the company because they kind of know more, and they feel like they're getting the full picture and not being left in the dark on anything. And I wish I could just do that with the entire team. Sometimes I think I can, and sometimes I think I can't.
Yeah. That sort of reminds me of a tweet from our friend Craig Hewitt. I just caught today or yesterday. He was talking about scaling up both of his companies, Podcast Motor and Castos. And he was just saying like, it's all about putting the right leadership team, those team members in place and getting out of the way as the founder to let them do what they do. And I feel like I've struggled with that, to be honest. I mean, with audience ops, it's great how process driven it is and how systematic it is. And I am very removed from it, but it doesn't have the same growth rate that it used to because I don't have people who are like tasked with the mission of grow it. You know, you come up with the ideas and grow it. And you know, I've kicked around that sort of stuff, but to be honest, my mental state is on process kit right now, and I'm trying to grow that. So
yeah, I wouldn't sell yourself short. It is very hard to accomplish what you have in audience ops in being removed to the degree that you are. But sure, I think that's fair for you to look at that and say it's not growing because you don't have a team specifically for let's grow this thing, right? So you are getting inbound, and now you have a salesperson, so you're moving in that direction.
Yeah. So actually, that's a good segue into what do we have for today. You know, we have a couple bullet points. Maybe we'll hit on some of these. Maybe we won't get to them. But I mentioned last week how I'm in like full on product development mode, like still bringing on customers and trials. And actually turned out the month of February was one of the best growth months yet, despite me being out of the country away from home for 2 of the 4 weeks and not really pushing too much. It was actually a really good month in terms of adding customers. But I decided that March and April and probably into May, it's just all about building the last couple of really important features that people keep asking for and not get distracted with all the other stuff. I would love to push on marketing and sales and stuff, but that has to wait until April or May, because I keep getting the same requests again and again, and these things have to be built and shipped, you know.
Yeah, so the pendulum is swinging more toward building. And look, I was very happy to see it in that email that you sent out about the growth. So that's great. Hopefully, what happens while you're focused on product is that it continues to grow and you are not giving up the growth just because you're focused on product. Hopefully, there's some residual effect from what you've done over the past few months.
Sometime last month, I talked about this last week, I tweaked the homepage messaging and positioning to be aimed at client services and teams and growing and scaling your client services business. And trial signups are still happening every single day, several a day. So it's that, I think, didn't break anything at least. So that's good. The other thing that's sort of on my mind right now, I don't know how public I want to be about this, but it relates to, I mentioned how I have a salesperson working on audience ops, taking all those inbound leads and talking to them. And I've been coaching her on that role. And I'm just trying to figure that out, like how I can be a better coach to her to get the most performance out of her, basically. It's been going pretty well so far, but of course it's early and yeah, I just have some kind of open questions that I'm thinking about there. So get into that a little bit. We talked a bit about hiring marketers, not me right now, but you know, you and we can kick. And I feel like a lot of people that I've spoken to, a lot of friends, a lot of founder friends have been thinking about, should I hire a marketer this year? Marketing person, what is that? What does that role entail? Who should I look for, or an agency, or what should I look for? So that'll be good.
Yeah, and we've been having conversations with agencies all week and next week also, and then going to make a decision. So we've just seen this wide range of approaches and styles, and that's very much on our mind also. The other thing I'd like to talk about is financing options. I spoke to a company called Pipe.com that very recently launched. Super, super interesting. So I'd love to explain a little bit about what they do. I think it's worth people knowing about that. And then the other piece is we've had much more personnel changes over the past 2 months than we normally have. That is super challenging for a small team, right? It's like, it's emotional, it's disruptive. At the same time, it opens up new opportunities. So just, I've been thinking a lot about that and the environment that I'm creating for employees and, you know, what do I not know about what their experience is like? And yeah, we'll definitely talk about that.
Very cool. Well, where should we kick it off?
Maybe we start with marketing.
Yeah, let's do that.
Right. So, all right, I'll talk
a little bit about— What is marketing, really?
That's literally what we wrote down. What is marketing? You know, like 40-year-old entrepreneurs who are, what is marketing anyway?
What are we doing here?
Yeah, what? I don't understand. So it does feel a bit confusing these days to wrap your mind around marketing. It feels like the most effective marketing is this word of mouth, attention, cult of personality, influencer thing that's happening.
When you see a natural word of mouth and a natural thing grow, I think it's as a result of the product being so noteworthy and connecting with a market in such a unique way. It sort of plays in a little bit to what, you know, Justin Jackson has been talking a lot about, of like, you know, you're in a very active market, you're seeing a wave of demand, and you've come to that market with the right solution at the right time, the right spin on it. You know, when you've chosen the right market and you've delivered a new and noteworthy, like a remarkable product.
Right, some innovation.
That's where, like, doesn't even really matter how much like ads and content you're doing. Like the thing starts to, people talk to each other about it.
Right, and that might be the ideal. And I fully understand the argument that Justin's making, that makes a huge impact on whether or not you're successful as a bootstrap entrepreneur. Now, but that what that doesn't really talk about is marketing itself. That's it's almost talking yeah. about.
It's not to say like you don't have to market. Obviously, you,
yeah. right? But it's effectively saying you need to market less. The marketing matters less if you're in this growing market that's hungry for solutions. And that's good. But all of us who have businesses that are up and running, we're sitting in our offices thinking, what should I be doing? It felt like a few years ago, these like straightforward strategies and tactics were being taught and being learned and implemented for the first time. And people were doing, okay, I'm going to get people onto a webinar. I'm going to make them a pitch, or I'm going to get people to download something. I'm going to get their email address, nurture them over time, and then make them an offer. You know, like the e-commerce physical product thing is more straightforward. Here's a picture. Here's what it does. Do you want to buy it? Right. Here's the shipping. Here's the price. The more complex sale of software is it's starting to get a little confusing on what you should be doing.
You can't do any blanket statements across the board because things definitely still work in some segments and they don't work in others. But I feel like at least for the types of B2B software that I buy, the lead magnet to webinar to, you know, nurture sequence, like that stuff doesn't work anymore. Like it's not effective. I need to hear about it and come across it, and it has to understand my business problem for me to give it the attention to go buy it, you know?
Right. Or the need pops up and then you go through your own special evaluation process of asking people in a private Slack group, doing a few searches, and then maybe you start to get followed by retargeting. It's like, but it's very confusing on what to do when you're in-house and you're saying, okay, how should we be spending our time and money on marketing to get more attention, to get more customers?
And then there's the other game of like the enterprise sales game. Like you identify the decision makers in the organization and you work those deals over months and you get the annual contracts, and there's that method of growth as well.
Yes. And that requires, you know, higher price points that can justify the time commitment and people commitment in order to accomplish that. But a lot of us that are caught in the middle, right, below those price points, it is genuinely tricky. And so our situation right now is that we actively do not want the lower end of the market. And so if you think about the high end of the market, if you think about the, you know, the decision makers at direct-to-consumer companies that are doing $1 to $20 million a year in revenue, maybe they're funded, maybe they're not, but you know, they have a measure of success, they have some sophistication, they have a few people on the team. Those people are not on Facebook, let alone on Facebook clicking on ads. So then what, you go to Instagram to start talking about your software, that's not very effective. Then you go to LinkedIn, no one that I really know is on LinkedIn that much. Then you're like, okay, so everyone's on Twitter, but Twitter ads don't work. You're like, okay, so then we do sales? Like, what playbook are we supposed to follow right now? We're talking to freelancers, we're talking to marketing agencies, we're talking to paid marketing agencies, we're talking to holistic, we'll do everything for you. We're talking to content agencies just to understand what is the landscape in 2020. What are people doing? Because what marketing people are selling as their services is some reflection of what people are doing on the market.
Yeah, so that's I think the challenge that I'm hearing from a lot of people, and I see it myself when I think about marketing. So like, do you hire just a quote unquote marketer, period? So head of marketing, and what are they? Are they just overseeing everything and they just run tests in all the different channels to see what works and what you want to double down on? So there's that option, or you've already defined like, okay, we know that we want to double down on organic content and SEO traffic. So we're going to go hire an SEO specialist or a content specialist. Or we know we want to go big on Facebook ads, so we'll hire somebody who knows Facebook ads and lives and breathes it every single day. Or maybe you hire a few of these people to run the, like, so on that question, I tend to lean more on hire the specialists and take the time internally, whether it's you as the founder or your team, to do the work of the evaluation of which channels we should be, you know, we should be doubling down on. Because I feel like there's a lot of people who are selling themselves as a general marketer, both has a role and agencies, saying we're a generalized marketing agency, we'll do all the things. For me personally, I have a hard time wrapping my head around, like, what am I really paying for here? Like, I feel like I'm paying for somebody to make a bunch of decisions and assumptions about my product and my customers. When I say my, I mean, like, if I have a larger team, like what we have built for this market, like, I feel like we come to the table with a lot of insights that we just need a marketer to go execute. And maybe I'm thinking about that a little bit too limited or something.
No, it depends. I don't know. Yeah. It depends on the situation. We are looking at it differently and saying we actually kind of want an outsourced team. And so, right, that's unique to our situation, where we had two marketers on the team, but the marketer that's been with us for 2.5 years is leaving. He's moving on to his next opportunity, and we're happy for him. It's awesome. He did a great job here. And at the same time, for us, we're now going down to one marketer in-house, our director of communications. And it also presents an opportunity for us to look at it with fresh eyes and say, okay, what do we need to do here? What do we need in-house versus not? And the way we're looking to solve it is, okay, let's, instead of hiring someone right away full-time, because we don't actually know what we need there. We don't know if we need someone.
That's sort of what I mean, is like, I'm completely all for outsourcing. I'm especially for outsourcing marketing for these specialized things. Yeah, I run a company that's for outsourcing your content. Like, yeah, I think that sort of makes sense. When you say outsource the marketing and you're talking to agencies, how are you evaluating them, and what are they pitching to you in terms of like what you're buying?
So it feels like there are two categories that we're talking to. One is paid media. One is, we will run your Facebook ads, Instagram ads, Google AdWords, and other things like that, between social and paid platforms and retargeting. And that's the focus. And what's your monthly budget? And what kind of ROI? And what are you looking to do? So for us, it's right, qualified leads through the application process. And that's one version of it. So focused on paid advertising that brings qualified leads.
For that group, that bucket, like, what's the typical cost structure there? Like, are most of these agencies still doing like a percentage, charging a percentage of their ads, of your ad spend? Is it just a flat fee? And what does that look like?
Some are charging a percentage of ad spend, and that depends on what you're doing. That may or may not make sense for you. And other people are doing flat or tiered, or it's like, look, if you're spending, you know, under 10 grand a month for paid ads, which would probably be the category that we're in for now, then it's, you know, it's flat, it's $5,000 or something like that. The marketing agencies that we've liked the most start off by saying, we want to do an audit. It's going to take 2 weeks. We're going to look at everything inside your funnel, what works, what doesn't work. And then we're going to come up with, here is where we think the opportunities are, and here's what we recommend for that. So that's what's drawn our attention the most. And instead of saying, we've decided that we want to do Twitter and Facebook ads and Google AdWords, and we want to hire specialists to execute on that. Instead of that, we almost are leaning more toward more holistic, more of a team approach, and that do the audit first. We can do everything because we have either people in-house, or we have a network of freelancers, but we're going to help you with the strategy, and we're going to audit what's working for you right now and not working. And then we're going to come up with a recommendation. It's more of a consultative approach.
Yeah. And it's like a paid audit.
Yes. It's more expensive, and it's also, it kind of builds confidence. And for us right now, that might make sense because that gives us leverage. That allows Lucy in-house to have a team at her disposal. And so, right, we want to go toward this month, and we want to do landing pages for these keywords that are working. Let's build up those landing pages so that then that marketing agency can build up the landing pages also.
I guess the question in my mind goes back to what we were just saying about the product doing the marketing. If it all starts with the product and your market, and you have an outside team who is tasked with auditing everything and coming up with strategies, recommending a way forward, and then managing the execution of that stuff, is there a line where it's like, okay, you're the marketing team, so you're not supposed to tell us, Cardhook or whatever company you're running, You're not supposed to tell us how we should price our product. You're not supposed to tell us which product features are more important and which customers we should be interviewing and things like that. Like, where's the line between understanding your customer, doing the customer research, even ongoing for an established company, and knowing where the market is changing, your industry changes, and making sure that what you're marketing is the right product for the right people and the right segment of the market? Like, how much of that goes into their work? Because when I think of an outsourced marketing team, I'm thinking like they're just executing.
Execution. I would prefer not to be just execution. I'm very open to not having it right on what we should be pushing, what we should be putting out first, what should we be highlighting. We've been doing this for a while and it's been working, but I'm very open to the best responses that I've gotten. I sent out a tweet and said, we're looking for a marketing agency. That was the double-edged sword. It was a lot to sort through, but there was a lot of quality in there also. And a lot of people just found my email address and wrote me thoughtful emails about what they think and do I want to talk to them about hiring them. And the best emails were the ones that completely challenged what I think. And they said, look, I have e-commerce experience. I've also worked with SaaS. And given what I know about your company, you have this position in the market, and I would be pushing this forward. And the reason I'd be pushing this forward is because of this. They're adding their opinion, and that feels more valuable than just, we have it right, we just need you to execute. That, so I don't know if it depends on the stage we're in or whatever unique set of circumstances. But it is like, okay, let's bring some fresh thinking in, right? Because the pro and con of losing someone on the team that's been there for 2.5 years is someone who really knows the product and knows the company, knows the DNA and the person, knows everything. We're losing that. That hurts. The upside of that is, okay, this is an opportunity to come at it from a completely different point of view. But it does feel, when we're actually in that conversation, the set of options feel weird. Like, you have paid, you have content, then you have events, you have sponsorships. And when you're trying to think about like the higher end, you're like, where are all those people? They're in newsletters. They're listening to podcasts. And those forms of spend are so disconnected from ROI. We're like, but we're not big enough to just spend without ROI.
Well, that was going to be my next question is like,
yeah, it's,
I'm sure you're probably asking the same question that I hear all the time when people are hiring audience ops and everything. And it is... For me, with audience ops, it frankly is the hardest question to answer. It's like, how should I think about ROI here? And we have some answers to that question, but like it is impossible to promise, like, yeah, you're going to see a 40% ROI within 6 months. You can't promise that to any client.
You can't. And then, so that means you have to have faith. And it's expensive faith. You say, okay, we're going to spend $5,000 a month on sponsorships between newsletters and podcasts. Do that for 6 months, that's 30K. What if it just doesn't bring anything back? that hurts. Where I'm starting to like come to terms with the need for sales, that's where it comes in. Where if you're going to do this awareness marketing that is less connected to ROI, then it really feels like it needs to be in combination with direct outreach of some type. And then you are capitalizing on that top of mindness that you're paying for, but that doesn't actually get someone to take action. You're almost taking the action for them, but it's reinforced by the fact that they just heard you on a podcast. And so you sponsor the LeanLux newsletter, and they saw you follow them on Twitter through retargeting ads.
I like the idea of the sales and the marketer working together in a constant feedback loop.
You know, yes.
The sales are talking to customers. They're learning new things every month. Those learnings go back into the marketing to change up how to improve those leads that the sales get to talk to.
Yes. So we had one conversation with someone who had been like a head of growth at a software company, but he's also in the e-commerce space. And he was the most like eye-opening conversation, because everyone else, we're talking about ads, we're talking about content. And he was like, okay, here's the deal. So you want to get to a point where you turn it into math, and, you know, and I come from this world, right? This is how I started the company. But I was sitting with Lucy and she was like, whoa, that was very different, right? He talked about, well, if you can get two people, incentivize them the right way, you ask them to make 20 videos a day that are personalized for that customer, that prospect, and then you need an outsourced video editor to put those up into a landing page and edit them. And then you need to follow up with a phone call, and then all your marketing is actually going to start to pay off. And it was like, Okay. That sounds to me.
So you're talking about a personalized outreach with a personalized message, a video, like targeted yes. at a highly researched prospect that
yes, you right. Know so is, this person has used Cartook before and for their clients. He's like, look, here's the deal. You need to take advantage of the fact that everybody knows your product and that people think highly of your product, but they all think it's really expensive. So like, what are you going to do in that situation? You're going to tell them you're awesome and then you're going to prove it to them. And then that's going to lower the barrier to the fact. Because he knew it. He's like, I saw the tweet. You guys have people that make $300,000 a month in upsells. It's okay to charge them $3,000 for it. It's fine. You don't have to shy away from it, but you do need to get into a conversation with them or they'll assume it's just too expensive for them.
Right. I like that approach too. And I've been thinking more about that for a process kit. Again, I'm not on marketing right now, but at some point this year, I would like to get into one-to-one outreach, direct outreach to target customers who fit a certain profile, whether that's email to, I've been thinking about that idea of like a personalized video, like show them their website and start the conversation there, send like lumpy mail stuff. And
Yep. One person pitched us that and said, look, there's a direct mail playbook that you could run also. And that gets you like 100% meetings, but it's more difficult and takes more time. It's cool diving back into this world. It does feel like we are going to pursue the marketing first and get that up and running and then layer in the sales and not try to do them both at the same time.
Right. Yeah, I guess speaking of that, I'll talk a little bit about the audience ops sales role. I'll say it's going pretty good so far. She did manage to close a couple of new clients pretty early on, so I was happy to see that. And I've been reviewing all the sales calls and I listen to the recordings and then she and I talk about them about once a week or so. You know, the big challenge for me overall with this whole endeavor is that I'm trying not to spend a lot of time on audience ops. You know, I still sort of like manage it and I've got managers in place who oversee day to day and they'll escalate updates to me and stuff like that. But since she's only like one full month into doing the calls herself, it's not the kind of thing that I can just run on autopilot. I have to actively.
Yeah.
It's a continuous training and coaching kind of routine right now with her. And to be honest, this is something that's pretty new to me. Like I've always obviously found it pretty easy to put stuff into a process and find the right role and put them into the system and get that stuff up and running. That's how Audience Ops has grown and my previous company too. But like, it's difficult because I was the one doing the sales calls for so long. And that's like the one thing that I never took the time to document anything about. I never took the time to formulate any sort of like strategy or framework that I use. A lot of it just, I did second nature. Like it came naturally, especially after years. I've been selling the Audience Ops product for like 5 years. I didn't realize it in the moment, but now that I'm trying to train someone else on doing it, I'm realizing all this strategy that I use on sales calls, whether it's like
unconsciously,
but when I think about it, like there is a methodology to what I'm doing and there's like a feel that you have to develop over time. Like I could within 2 minutes of talking to a new person and checking out their website, I can put them into like one of three or four different buckets of common leads that I talk to. And I know exactly how to talk to each one differently. And then based on how the first 10 minutes go, what I learn from asking them a certain series of questions, I know how I'm going to tailor my answers to the key benefits that are most important to them. Like just little things that you pick up over time that help put the person at ease. And I'm trying to like get this stuff across to her. And she's not new to talking to customers because she's been a manager for Audience Ops for so long, but she's never talked to them before they became clients, you know? And that is a super different conversation to have.
Yes, it is.
The things you talk about before they pay money to the things they talk about after they're on board and they've paid. It's a completely different conversation, you know?
Yeah. It's like writing an email to your friends versus writing a business email. Everyone acts differently, thinks differently. It's like it takes on a different version of your personality.
Yeah. And part of it for me is like I've always taken a very low pressure, low to no pressure approach with sales. Like, really, I am just asking questions. Like, literally the whole call, all I'm doing is asking questions. And then near the end, I'll say, like, if you have any questions for me, and then I'll just answer their questions. And I hear the same ones again and again, and I know how to answer all of them. The key thing that I'm trying to get across to her is, like, you really don't need to sell audience ops. The idea is that it sells itself, because they've come to us organically. They heard about it, or they found our website, they Googled, they liked what they saw there, they saw our pricing on the homepage, then they filled out a multi-form form, and then they booked a call, and then they showed up for the call. So all of that they did without us even doing any work.
Right. A lot of intent.
Yeah, a lot of intent. And then even after that, before they talk to us, they watch a 10-minute demo video. And they're still interested. They still show up. So they come to us more than 50% sold. You just need to facilitate that buying process, really. And so I guess I'm having a little bit of a hard time figuring out, like, how to teach this stuff that just came kind of second nature. You know, when I have the calls with her every week, I just feel like it's a lot of me rambling. You know, I heard this call and here's how I would have answered that and how I would have answered this and blah, blah, blah. And I'm just, I don't know. It doesn't seem systematic like the rest of the business right now. It's kind of tricky.
That's tricky. It feels like a pretty unique skill set, right? It's a little bit like a sales leader, sales manager thing, but this is its own version of sales. It's the fully qualified, all that intent, all that action. You really just don't want to get in the way of the sale. You just need to take any existing barriers and give the answers that lower those barriers. Has she listened to any of your calls?
Yeah. So that was her first month on the job, was just listen to my calls. And then we talked about it, and she had a lot of questions for me. We went through that. And then starting in February was when, okay, now all the calls go to you and I listen to your calls now and we review them. And so it's just tricky, you know. And the other thing that's hard about it is that I'm the founder and the business owner who was doing the sales, and I'm trying to train a non-founder, non-business owner to do the sales. And so I have a different approach. I can just naturally come at these conversations with sales leads in a much different way than someone else. Because, like, number one is I'm talking to other SaaS, B2B SaaS founders. So the first 15 minutes of the call, I'm just talking shop with people who I like to talk to anyway. You know, like,
gets built up over those conversations.
A lot of it is, like, literally the same conversations that I have in the hallways at MicroComp. It's like, you know, I love talking to other B2B SaaS founders. So we can build that rapport, you know.
Right. Which is its own version of magic, but she doesn't have to be, it doesn't have to have the exact same process and feel that the conversation with you feels. It's not going to. Right? I'm the same way when I used to do demos, and Katie does more than just fine on the demos. She's excellent at it. She found her own voice and her own way to explain, her own way to talk through things that builds up rapport and relationships in her way. So, right, maybe it's starting off tight. Here's how it's done. Here's how I do it. Here's what works. But then giving them the confidence to get out there on the field and kind of figure out their own style and their own playing, you know, preferences and so on.
I mean, the good thing is that, like, she really knows audience ops so well. She's one of our best longtime managers. So I'm never worried about her saying the wrong thing or giving incorrect information. She's always on the ball there. It's more about, like, the finesse of asking the right question at the right time, saving the answers for when you get asked and when you can really use that answer, that rather than trying to dump all this information within the first 5 minutes. Like, that's a big one that I keep trying to get across, is, like, you just need to answer the question, just need to focus on the benefits. You don't need to get too into the details and the process. You could save a lot of these answers until when they're ready to hear that answer and things like that.
Yeah, but you have to give that criticism in a way that doesn't cut their confidence.
Yeah, that's
still encouraging, that's the danger is if you overwhelm someone with criticism, then they won't be sure of themselves and then they'll get into their own head. And then they are, it's very hard to be yourself, and you want to be yourself. You want to be authentic when you're selling.
This is what I'm not very good at. I feel like I'm not, you know, and I think she's really strong and she's really naturally talented. So, but I could sense that.
Tell her that.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
But I could sense she's trying to like work with me as like help you a little bit. Like, I don't know.
Yes. It's look, I think it's tricky. Extremely tricky. Yes.
What like just you know, on the thing about like business owner talking, selling to another business owner. It's the other thing about that is that sometimes in certain cases, like if the lead is trying to be challenging to me or something like that, or like giving me a hard time, like, you know, why should audience ops work for me? Or like, what are you going to do to win my business? That kind of thing. My immediate approach is like, all right, well, like I don't take that shit. Like we're here. This is how we work. You know,
right.
This is why it's valuable. You don't have to sign up for us. You could just go hire a freelancer. That might be a good fit for you. Or you could hire us because a lot of people come to us after the freelancer didn't work. I can kind of convey this sense of like confidence. And it's a little bit difficult for her to be like, you know, take it or leave it, like, you know.
But I think you can get there, right? What you're talking about is this intangible confidence that people are drawn to. When someone gives you that reaction, you rarely shy away from it. It makes you want that more. And part of that confidence comes from the fact that you get to make the decision, and it's your company and it's your money. And putting an employee in that position makes them hesitate and feel like, well, do I have the right to say no to a customer? And it took us that trial to demo process that has like defined 2019 for us was that at the company level. It was, this is ridiculous. These people are not fun to work with and we're just not going to take it. And it still took repeated conversations around, I trust you guys. If that person is a bad customer, refund them, cancel their account, and send them a link to our competitor. And like, you're allowed to do that. You can decide to do that. I know it's $500 a month, but if you decided that, I trust you to make that decision. So you have the power to do it. And that confidence built over time will get them thinking like an owner, talking like an owner, and then sounding like an owner to prospects, and then they'll have their own magical draw of confidence. It's like a steam building. It's like, yes.
Yep.
Oh, I love that. Love that stuff.
Yeah, it's tricky. Yeah. But anyway, so cool. And you know, again, it's like I want that stuff to improve. I think I clearly is improving. Like I told her yesterday when we talked, like the more recent calls, clearly like she's taking the notes that I've been giving her and I'm seeing the improvements. But at the same time, it's like, man, I don't want to spend an hour listening to these calls right now. I'd rather be working on Process Kit, you know, but got to do it. So what else?
Well, we can talk about some financing stuff, which might be boring, but I find exciting. And then we can talk about personnel changes being hard around the team. Maybe we go there because the last conversation, what we're having is about people. So we have had more personnel change than ever before. We let someone go maybe 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, nothing like big and dramatic, like they'd been with us for 2 years and it just started to make sense for both them and the company for them to move on to the next thing. And it was like this very amicable kind of great way to do that. I think they're going to be better off and so are we. Then we let someone more junior go about a week ago, which was really difficult because she's a support and she's a great person, sweet, good, nice, smart, hardworking, like all that stuff. It's just that the need of the company changed. It changed severely enough that's what the company demanded. And I've learned over time that just letting that go and ignoring it is not good for anybody. Not good for the team, not good for the company, not good for the person, all that stuff. So right,
what changed? Was it like, did things get more technical or what?
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. It got more technical and just the demand on onboarding has increased, right? We're talking to bigger and bigger merchants, and their needs are more sophisticated, and we need far more engineering experience on the front of house, right? On the customer side of onboarding and sales and success and support. And that's why we're hiring a customer engineer now, and we're looking for much more senior experience. And back when we hired this person, that was like, oh, those needs weren't like that. We needed someone in support that had technical knowledge and could check out some JavaScript and let the person know what was wrong and hear some errors and try this. And that made sense at the time. And now it's not like that. I think about Netflix sometimes as one extreme of management. You know, they do the no heart, completely cold, what do they call it? Right. We're a sports team. We're not a family. We're a sports team.
In terms of their support,
right? In terms of the way they look at team members, the way they look at hiring and firing.
Oh, okay.
Like, we are a professional sports team, and we don't. Right. Let's just say.
Oh yeah. Like if your stats aren't competing, it can't work.
Or yeah. Sometimes it's not even that. Sometimes it's like almost external, where it's like if you're in the Eastern Conference and you're getting creamed by this really big center, guess what? If your center is not big enough, you got to get a big center. Like it's nothing personal. It's not even about performance. It's just like, look, that's what it needs. So we're swapping you out. And so that's one extreme. And I think that's too extreme, right? I also think like we're a family and everyone loves each other and all that. That's not honest either. But it felt almost Netflix-y, where it was like, we can ignore that or we can just acknowledge it. So that happened, and then our marketer resigned, and his last day is today, and there's like this great send-off. He's been with us for 2.5 years, done a fantastic job. He was ride or die, whatever the company needed, the whole way. And now he's moving on to his next opportunity, and we're happy for him. It's great. But it's, you know, it's a few people within a few weeks.
Yeah, it sounds like just that it was like a coincidence of timing with all these different people at the same time.
Yes. And again, in the past, I would have looked at that and hesitated on making that type of a move because I would be very worried about how's the team going to feel and can they handle it? And what about the morale? You know, and I hesitate a lot less now, for better or worse, but it definitely has me thinking about, okay, if I'm a junior person at this company, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? Are they worried about their job security? Do they think this is financial in nature, or is it strategic? Should I believe what I'm hearing? What about all those meetings that the senior people are having that I'm not in? Should I be worried about what they're saying? You know, it's like, how do I create this environment of confidence when people see their friends, right? It's not like the person in the group over there with the other 20 people that doesn't really affect the group of 20 people that I'm in is gone and that's sad and I liked seeing her in the hallway. It's not that. It's the person sitting next to me that we order lunch together and we like take walks together and I know about their family and I know about their hopes and dreams and the next day they're just gone. And then, you know, homie who seems like a nice guy in the corner over there just told me, unfortunately, we have to let this person go and these things are tough and this is the worst part of the job. And, you know, from their point of view, it's like, huh, what am I supposed to be thinking here?
Yeah.
So
yeah. It's got to be tricky. I only had really one full-time office job I was there probably for 2.5 or 3 years at a web development agency in New York. And I was like one of the most junior employees there at the time. I was in my like early 20s. And I remember like there were a few personnel changes while I was there. I was like, oh, whoa, that came out of nowhere. Like, you know,
yes.
And that was always tricky.
It rarely comes out of nowhere, right? At least
you're junior,
yes.
You don't know what's going on.
Exactly. You don't know what's going on.
Yeah.
Right. So how transparent should you be? How much of this is just the nature of business where you could be as empathetic and careful and thoughtful as you want? You're still taking a job away from someone. And I didn't know all the reasons because I'm in this different position. So look, when it happens every once in a while, right, it has this natural concussion effect, boom, and then it comes back to normal. But a few of these in a row, so I'm thinking about that a lot. And yesterday we went to happy hour to say goodbye to this employee who was leaving today. And it was fun. And it was, I looked around and we were talking about things other than work and life experiences. And I was like, ooh, I almost forgot about this. We got to do this more often. This is the other part of the relationships and trust and fun that builds up a buffer. It builds up like a trust battery.
What does that look like with the office in Portland? Like, how often are you guys socializing, doing happy hours, doing stuff like that?
How often does that happen? They do it more often than I do. Right. Yeah. I have 3 young kids. Right.
They've got the happy hours where they all talk shit about the boss.
Yeah. I love knowing for a fact, even though I don't know for sure, I still know there's definitely a group out there called Everyone But Jordan.
Okay.
Like in Slack. There's definitely.
Of course.
That channel.
I feel that's healthy exists, though. That needs to exist.
Absolutely. It needs to exist. And I need to just trust that and let that be hopefully an accurate reflection of reality. Right. Because for sometimes good, sometimes bad.
We're remote, and I also know for a fact that, you know, the team is DMing each other, and there's plenty of stuff that, like, I've seen team members hang out with, like, get together in person, you know, out in California or wherever. And I think that's awesome. And
it's absolutely it's necessary. So what does it look like? They're doing it more than I am, right? They're going out, they're having drinks, they're having dinner, that sort of thing. There is an element to...
What does lunch look like?
I'm isolated.
You're doing your own. Like, do people go out together? Do you guys bring in for like a... Like one thing that we did at that agency in New York, this was like, whatever, 12, 15 years ago. They did a lot of that kind of stuff. Like every Friday they'd order in Thai and we'd all eat together.
That's,
you know, at least once
we
a
do
month
that
we did like
every other, we'd do that. Every other week.
Yeah. Cool.
Every other week on Friday, company buys lunch, everyone hangs out and talks, and yeah, that sort of thing. And day to day, it depends. So sometimes there'll be, you know, I can see on Slack people talking, hey, I'm thinking about getting this lunch. Anyone want to join me? I personally like to have lunch by myself. That's my time to unwind. I take a walk. Maybe I call my brother or something. I get lunch. I walk back. I eat by myself. I'm watching TikToks. You know, it's like my unwinding time. But it plays a role, you know, and there's definitely something isolating. And my wife said it too. She's like, I love your team, but I'm definitely the boss's wife, and everyone treads pretty lightly.
Of course. Of course.
There's nothing to gain from that interaction.
Yeah. Right.
Yep.
Yeah.
No, tricky. It's good. But the personal dynamics and how they relate. And it is amazing how easy it is to make mistakes in the course of these actions. Letting someone go is so complicated. And I've made many mistakes in the course of letting people go. And so now when we do it, it is super careful. And we are talking about it. We're thinking, how does this affect this person? How does it affect the other person? Who do we need to talk to first? Who is their team lead? What do people need to know? When are we going to do it? How are we going to do it? Because you can't be callous about these things. It's serious. So it needs to be taken very carefully for the person and for the people who are staying. And it has definitely been a learning process. And Ashley, my outsourced people coach, has been a savior on that end. And it's hard every single time.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, you know, that is really tricky.
Yep.
Well,
all right, man.
Should we call it?
Yeah, I think we did it. You know, I'm sure there's more, but we'll save that for next week. We think we can do it again next week.
Maybe 3 in a row. We'll see. Yeah, I think I'll be here. So
I think we can do it. And
all right.
And MicroConf, we're going to beat coronavirus. No canceling MicroConf.
Come on. We will get there.
Look, if they cancel it, just keep your tickets, and we'll meet up in Minneapolis. All right.
Yeah, let's just still go. And
We'll get a WeWork conference room. We'll do a big snow medium conf.
All right.
In Minneapolis.
I'm in.
All right, brother.
Good stuff.
Good to see you. Thanks everyone for listening. Have a great weekend.
All right. Later.